Roses are red, violets are blue.
Brian, if you make another pun, I will fucking kill you.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects, a veritable Whitman sampler of underrated and underseen films. I am your lovable host, Brian Salisbury. No, that's not up for debate. And I am joined by the other half of my golden BFF pendant, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year! It's December, but we're getting there. We are getting there for sure.
Okay. Well, I'll get it right eventually.
To remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Well, December is here and tis the season. The trees are trimmed, the lights are dimmed, and the horror movies are on constant rotation here at Junk Food Cinema headquarters. Aw yeah. Lots of blood and destruction. So all this month, we're celebrating our favorite holiday-based horror films. And, I mean, sure, Halloween is the most memorable. It's the most well-known of all holiday horror flicks. But we're going to forego Carpenter's masterpiece because if you don't know why Halloween's great at this point in your life, like, I don't even know what we could possibly tell you.
Yeah, like us doing an episode on Halloween is just kind of, you know, it's even more masturbatory than normal. it's like, hey, this week we're talking about the greatest underrated films, Jaws, Jurassic Park, Halloween, with this little known alien film called E.T., maybe The Thing. Yeah, no, we're not going to fucking do Halloween. In fact, we talked about that. We're like, let's do a month of holiday movies, but we can't do Halloween. Like, yes. Let's just skip Halloween. And let's try to do, we'll do the ones that we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's apparently two holidays coming up, but yes. I didn't really know.
Yes.
I don't know because all of these people keep coming up saying happy holidays to me as opposed to naming the holiday in question, which offends me to my very core. Not really, but you know.
But for the purposes of this joke, it does.
For the purposes of this joke, it could offend me to my core.
I'm surprised you have a core.
I have two. In fact, I have the core.
Oh,
and we will address the core eventually, sir.
Hold on. If we're going to start talking about the core already. All right. Okay.
So I already have plans in the works to find a way to get the core in, and it will happen. And I assure you, I have found a way to make you go along with this. Mm. But we'll move on to what we're talking about now, which is holiday movies. And we decided to pick holidays that, you know, don't normally get covered. And it allows us to talk about a film that we're going to talk about tonight that was one of the first movies you and I watched together.
Yeah.
That wasn't in a theater.
That's right.
You and your roommate came over to my place to watch a couple of movies. This had just come out on DVD in a re-release because they had released a remake of it that will be mentioned tangentially in this episode.
In the most passing of passing.
In the passing of passings. But we sat down to watch this because you guys had never seen it and I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. And we were just all like, holy shit, this movie is really fucking good.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, we're trekking across the rest of the calendar to point out some of the films that thoroughly destroy the joy of a few other holidays, and this one is certainly amongst them. Starting in February, we're showing some major love to My Bloody Valentine.
In the town of Valentine Bluffs, there are many ways to die. My Bloody Valentine.
Hell yes.
And it's very fitting, actually, to start with this movie, which is a 1981 Canadian slasher. The origin of the film, according to the producers, is that during the big slasher boom, they specifically wanted to find a holiday in which a slasher film had not been set already. Now, keep in mind, this is 1981.
Yes.
And already they're like, oh, shit, what holidays are left? That's how quickly the slasher boom happened.
Well, there's that whole big thing that happened in that, you know, Friday the 13th came out. Halloween came out in 79, and Halloween melted brains.
Totally.
And then Sean S. Cunningham went and completely ripped it off.
Yeah.
For Friday the 13th. But Friday the 13th is what really changed the paradigm.
Yeah.
Everyone, you know, people were inspired by Halloween, but they looked at it and they said, oh, what a masterful movie. And it was a big hit film. But Friday the 13th was cheap and it was bloody and it was effective and critics hated it and nobody cared what the critics thought. And it made money.
Yeah.
And it made so much money that Paramount couldn't stop making them and eventually sold the license so that they could get the blood off their hands, so to speak. But what happened was once Friday the 13th came out, all these imitators followed immediately. And within the next year, I think there was something like 32 to 35.
It's absurd. It's an absurd
slasher
number.
Films released. It was literally one new slasher film came out every week and a half in 1981. And this was one of those where it's like, we got to catch up on, you know, we got to get in on this. And, you know, it was this wonderful, delightful little Canadian production.
And interestingly enough, ended up getting distributed by Paramount. And what I think is great about My Bloody Valentine is that it effectively mixes a lot of elements of Friday the 13th as well as of Halloween.
Yes.
And does it in a really interesting way. And we'll get to that momentarily. But first, I want to talk about some of the similarities between this film and Friday the 13th. Well, a quick backstory here. This film takes place in a little town called Valentine Bluffs. And Valentine Bluffs had this situation where many years ago, 20 years ago, in fact, they'd been throwing this big, obviously when your town is called Valentine Bluffs, Valentine's Day is your big holiday. That's the one you celebrate because you have town pride.
You have now officially explained it more than the movie explains it.
Yes, yes. So they throw this big holiday dance, but in 1960, there's a situation where the townspeople that are the men are employed by this local mine. And in 1960, the two foremen of the mine decide they want to go to the party more than they want to finish up doing their safety procedures. And it ends up getting seven men trapped in the mine. 6 weeks later, they finally get to them and find only one of them has survived by eating all of the other ones, and now he's gone insane. That's pretty much the backstory. And you jump ahead to 1980, and the town is throwing its first Valentine's Day in 20 years, and then some things start happening, and a little more to the legend starts coming out, and you realize that this is a town that's been plagued by problems around this holiday. So that's the basic premise. But as far as similarities to Friday the 13th, the backstory is about negligence causing death.
Yep.
I mean, honestly, you could have said, they were at that party while those poor miners died. And then also you have, in the film, the Crazy Ralph character. You may remember Crazy Ralph from Friday the 13th, whose whole motif is just, it's got a death curse. That's camp blood. You can't go there. It's cursed. And sure enough, there's this old, crotchety bartender.
This ain't no fairy tale, little girl. If you don't take it seriously, you're a fool.
Who has maybe one of the best deaths
in
the movie.
Isn't his name Happy?
I think his name is Happy. I think that is correct.
I think he's Happy. Which is...
when he goes, it ain't happy. Let me just tell you that much. So that's a similarity as well. And then you have all of the victims, for the most part, working together in one place. Summer camp versus mine. You also even have the buffoonish, quote-unquote, funny guy character who, you know, you throw an Indian headdress on the guy in My Bloody Valentine, and he would be the goofy buffoon character from Friday the 13th. And here's the really funny thing. The caption at the beginning of the movie states that all of the action starts on Thursday, February 12th. Now, obviously, the big bloodletting is going to happen on Valentine's Day, which would be 2 days later on Saturday, the 14th, which means at a certain point in the movie that's not ever actually stated, it's Friday the 13th.
It does say that it is the 13th, but they never say that it's Friday.
Exactly. Yeah, they go through the days kind of taking you through everything that happens, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, part of this does happen on Friday the 13th.
It's a clever little inside thing that they didn't actually make a... they didn't do what most people would do. You go, huh?
Nah. They let math make the joke for them and just trusted you to figure it out.
That's right.
You got to give a nod. You got to give a nod there. But as much as this movie does owe its existence to Friday the 13th, it doesn't function the same way that most slashers do.
No.
because it actually operates narratively as its own sequel. Like, if you really think about the way this plays out,
20 years ago, Harry Warden broke out of a mental institution and came back to get revenge on those who caused the cave-in that put him there.
That sounds like the plot of My Bloody Valentine 1.
Not only that, but there's dialogue in this movie that sounds like 80s dialogue from sequels. Like, there's the, you know, you have the sheriff going around going, oh no, not again.
This can't be happening again. Yeah. It's like, we haven't seen it happen the first time.
Yeah.
Except in flashback, which feels very much like if you saw any of the Friday the 13th sequels where they did what I called the last week on Jason, where they would just like replay the first few minutes of the previous film, like right at the beginning of the movie. That's what it feels like. But that's the only exposure we have to Harry Warden, this killer who is decked out in miner's garb with the hat and the oxygen mask and swinging a big mother-loving pickaxe. Like, that's the only exposure we really have to him at the beginning of the movie, is everything they told us has happened before. So I could easily see somebody coming into this movie and going, well, wait, I haven't seen the first one. I feel like I'm going to be lost. There is no first one. You're watching the first one right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool about it. And then the actual plot after that, it feels like the second installment of the franchise. It feels like, you know, we tried to warn you not to. It, you know what? Actually, during the course of the movie, not only do they say that this is the first Valentine's Day dance they've had in 20 years, but then it gets canceled again. And it very much reminds me of a plot device that's used in the Halloween franchise, where after a certain point, I think it's, I want to say it's like Halloween 5 or 6. They're like, Haddonfield does not celebrate Halloween anymore.
Yeah.
Because this shit keeps happening. And that kind of feels like this plot device where it's like, we haven't had this dance in 20 years because what happened?
Well, the interesting thing about that is just how what they do is you have these characters that take this threat seriously from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, normally the kid, how these films operate is one of the kid characters, you know, one of the protagonists, who doesn't belong to authority, finds out, realizes what's going on, and then runs to the authority, and they're like, yeah, yeah, kid, whatever. Yeah, the story of Harry Warden. Yeah, no, we've all heard that old nugget.
Yeah, or the Sam Loomis moment where it's like, you know what, just calm down. We'll take care of it. It's like, no, you don't understand. He's evil. Yeah. I shot him 6 times.
Oh, wow. I didn't know Obi-Wan Kenobi was in...
they sound alike. I can't help that they sound alike.
They do, actually.
They do sound alike, goddamn it.
Obi-Wan Kenobi is...
How dare you.
But here, instead, the authority figures know exactly what's going on. They're trying to prevent a panic, and they're what makes it to where the kids don't believe that this is a real credible threat.
Yeah.
And they're trying to shut it down, and they just think they're being old fuddy-duddies and trying to find any reason to shut down their fun and their dance, because they live in a shithole Canadian mining town, mm-hmm. and their lives kind of fucking suck.
Right.
And this is their one excuse to get laid in places that aren't their own beds. And so they're really excited about this notion. But I love that the minute that something happens, none of the authority figures try to write it off. They are in it the entire time. And in fact, it is fate that has to intervene. You know, he's like, I have this bad feeling about the mine. So he starts driving to the mine. It's like, Sheriff, you got to get back here. You got a phone call. And it's like, well, shit. And they're really actively trying to prevent this thing from happening. Yeah. And I think that really, really helps this work.
Yeah, and I think another thing that really sets this apart from most slashers is that in most slashers, the characters are disposable murder fodder. And in this film, you really do like a lot of these characters. And the town itself feels very lived in. It has the texture of a real small town.
Well, there's two major elements that I wanted to bring up that you just kind of addressed in a big broad stroke. There's two elements to that make this movie still worth watching here nearly 35 years later. It is, one of them is that they've replaced the teenagers with blue-collar workers. Mm-hmm. And they're very likable blue-collar workers. These are people who, they do all the things that the teens do in the teen films. You know, they sneak off to have sex, they drink a lot of beer, they smoke a little dope. You know, you have all that, but you have in the way that's very blue collar and very realistic.
Yeah, they do all that stuff after working all day in a goddamn mine.
Yeah, and it's like, and when they're in the mine, they're fucking dead serious, and they're doing their thing, and everybody's doing, and they're just like, I can't wait to get out of this fucking job, and then they get out, and they're like, let's go out to the junkyard and fucking have some six packs, cook up a fucking TV dinner on an engine block.
Which is amazing.
And let's just fucking, just hang out. And hey, by the way, we're all just normal, and it's interesting how they do it. My favorite relationship in the whole movie is actually, I don't remember the characters' names, but they're essentially the secondary characters. You've got the big overweight
Hollis. He's my favorite character in the whole movie.
Big overweight burly guy with this hip, what would be now a hipster handlebar mustache.
Yeah.
And he's got this smoking hot, adorable, lovable girlfriend who when you see them together, the two actors have genuine chemistry.
Totally.
And you look at it and go, if they weren't fucking, then they are the greatest actors ever. But I've never seen them again in anything else. So clearly, you know, something was going, but it just, it, and the thing is it really feels like every small town you've ever been in where, you know, you look at those people and their few interactions with one another and you get why they're together. You know, mm-hmm. It's the type of thing that if you put that in a horror movie now, you'd be like, why is the cute girl with the fat guy? That's not the character archetypes I'm used to. And instead it's
but
like,
as a character archetype that I totally promote and support 100%.
Well, that we here at Junk Food Cinema are 100% behind hot women that like overweight guys.
Yes, indeed.
And
let's keep that trend going if we can, please.
Yeah. So that element, it feels very real. It feels very authentic. And then you have the other portion of this, which is you have this amazing B story that really drives the narrative. And that's one of the problems that most of these slasher films have, is that they don't have a decent B story, that they want you to focus on just the slasher stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to find whatever they can do to make you care about these protagonists in some way, shape, or form. And here, they just do it with straight storytelling. Yeah. You have this character who's just come back from the West Coast. He left the town. He's like, fuck you, town. I'm out of here. I'm blazing both fingers mid both fingers akimbo, and I'm going out to make my fortune in the world. And he failed. He fucked up, crawled back home, and his dad, who's the rich guy who owns the mine, is like, you fucked up. You left us. Go back to work in the fucking mine with your friends. Mm-hmm. And he has to go back to work with his friends, but his best friend is now with his girl.
Yeah.
And he is having a hard time with that. And she's clearly having a hard time with that. And his buddy's having a hard time with that. And they're all having this great love triangle that really feels very messy and raw and realistic in a way that you feel for all of them, because yeah, this guy came back to town and he was in love with this girl and he really fucked up and he really should have called her and he really should have wrote her, but he didn't. And she ended up with the guy that stayed and planned on staying. And now that the other guy's back, it's like, well, I love that guy, but he kind of fucking left me swinging in the wind and didn't take me with him. And this guy stuck around, and that's what I need to spend the rest of my life with. But I'm still attracted to his wild, you know, sensational, brooding dark ways. And it really drives that plot up until the, you know, up through the final moments of the film.
Yeah, and we'll get to the way that it kind of turns convention on its ear when it comes to slasher films even further in just a moment. I want to talk for a second about the killer in this movie. Because a lot of times the way you sell a slasher film, and the way you definitely sold slasher films back then, is that you sold the look, the mystique, the mythos of the actual killer. You know, whether that was hockey masks and machetes, whether that was, you know, the in The Prowler, for example, the old World War II helmet. There was always a distinctive look to your killer that would kind of define, you know, in a lot of ways, your franchise, if you had a franchise, or in this case, your single film. And I absolutely love, like, as much as I'm a big fan of the Friday the 13th franchise, it's where I really cut my teeth in horror. I think Harry Warden is like my favorite in terms of look and design. It's kind of my favorite slasher killer. I just love the miner's gear. It has such a naturally offsetting quality to it with the big kind of goggly eyes and the one light up top that's very disorienting. And, you know, it's one of those things that I've always found really really unsettling about slasher killers, like, you know, Michael Myers, William Shatner mask and things like that, is you can never – there's no change in expression. And I think it's even more elevated with something like the miner's gear and the pickaxe. Like, it's just kind of the perfect package of creepy elements that I think come together really nicely.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say of that era, it is definitely one of the most evocative of the era. I don't know if I would say it's my favorite, but I have always loved that look so much so that really is the best thing that they adapted into the remake. Was they kept that specific look and they didn't try to update it and go, we're going to be hip and cool. It's like, no, this worked and it still fucking works and it's still fucking creepy. And that element did really transcend.
One of the few things that they did get right in the remake, and I stress very, very few things they did get right.
Let's just come out and say it. You and I, there's no love lost for that remake. There are a lot of people that really enjoy that film, and there's a couple of nice little geek nods in there, but I'm really not a fan of the remake. And the my biggest problem with the remake, I can list a litany of moments that I.
But we only have an hour, so
yes. But the biggest problem is that it was a trend in Hollywood for a period of time. During the last decade, to go ahead and shoot a horror movie like this with multiple endings and shoot multiple endings and not tell anyone in the cast or crew which ending they were going to use. Mm-hmm. This is one of the big movies they did that with. So there are three functionally different endings to this movie. Now, ordinarily, you're thinking like, okay, so it's got a different ending, so what? The thing is each ending had a different killer, meaning that this story has to support three different potential killers and have it make sense, and it actually doesn't. And you get to the end of the remake, you're like, wait a second, what about this and this and this? And none of it logically holds up, and it makes it ridiculous, and it's like you literally grabbed that ending out of a hat.
How have you done your job as a writer in creating the breadcrumbs that lead to three interchangeable endings? That doesn't even, like, conceptually, that doesn't make any sense.
And it may not be something that the writer did. It may be something that the director decided to do and ended up shooting three different things. And you cannot, as a writer, unless you're super clever about it, like super, super clever, write a series that, I mean, this was, what was it? What was that series called about 5-6 years ago? Harper Island? Was that the name of it? There's a cool CBS TV series that was a single season slasher TV show about a bunch of people on an island, had a great cast, really cool show. Great iconography, great, you know, cinematography. It just looked and felt creepy. And every episode, one of the major characters bit it at the hands of the slasher killer. And it was just a neat show.
Huh.
Yeah. And it's one of those shows that sitting down and marathoning is a lot of fun, except they did that same thing on that show where no one on the show knew who the killer was. Mm-hmm. So the performances don't really match up.
Right.
It's one of the things that when you find out who the killer is, it's not awful. It's not like, oh, that just ruined the show. But it is one of those things where it's like, oh, man, now this guy's performance doesn't really pay off in the way, you know, it just feels inauthentic. And it made what was a really cool show kind of disappointing. Though if you guys are slasher fans out there checking this out, that's what it's called, right? You're looking it up, Harper Island?
I tried to look it. I couldn't find it under Harper Island.
Oh,
I'm trying to figure out what the name is.
Somebody will no doubt in the comments mention what
they'll figure it out.
Yeah, but it is it was a cool show. And so that's the problem with the remake, is that it really does nothing it sets up ends up being properly paid off, and it feels like the ending is a cheat.
Yeah.
And I don't like that, which does lead me to want to talk about the ending of this film.
Yeah. What we really need to talk about is the fact that there are two versions of this film. There is the version that was released in theaters for years and years and years and years, the only version that existed. And then there is the 2009 DVD that actually puts back a few of what director George Milhaka has said is about 8 or 9 minutes of footage that was removed. The MPAA apparently requested cuts. They requested cuts to every single death scene in the movie. And even after doing that, even after cutting the movie for their requirements, the MPAA still came back with an X rating on it. And more cuts, even more cuts were demanded. And even today, like the version that's on this DVD, this Blu-ray now that has also come out, which is great. It's a great transfer.
Yeah.
They really have done a good job putting this stuff back in.
Looks beautiful.
And you can tell, what's great about it is you can tell where the extra lost footage comes in, because it's not up to snuff with the same quality as the Blu-ray. But it's fun to me. That's almost like a little visual benchmark, like a visual signature. Like, okay, now this is what's been added in that wasn't there before. There are two reasons, basically, that Milhaka says that they were forced to cut the movie down. Paramount wanted to remove the extreme footage because backlash they actually received from Friday the 13th the previous year. So the reason this movie exists is also partially the reason that it was so cut down, is that everything was owed to Friday the 13th. It was like, you exist because of Friday, and the problems that Friday had in theaters became your problems as well. They had just released Friday the 13th Part 2 at the same time as My Bloody Valentine. And Friday the 13th Part 2 also had extensive cutting, and actually the full version of that movie doesn't exist anywhere. The full version of Friday the 13th Part 2 is nowhere to be found. And the other reason, according to Milhaka, is that the death of John Lennon happened in December 1980.
Mm-hmm.
This film comes out almost directly after.
Which, by the way, we're recording on the anniversary of.
Oh my God, we are.
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yes. 34 years ago, John Lennon was killed. And I'd like to think that if he were still around today, he would say, help, let me out of here. I'm not dead.
Oh, for God's sake. So there was a major backlash.
You asked for that.
I guess so. There's a major backlash against movie violence in the wake of his death. And like, so it was another, I mean, we talked about this before, where movies, because of situations completely out of their control in the real world, have, like, you know, we talked about with Reign of Fire, about when it was about to premiere on TV in the UK, and all of a sudden these bombings happen, and people don't want to see a movie where London is burned to a cinder. Like, it's that kind of situation.
Well, this happened back after 9/11. You know, Hollywood had a very serious discussion about doing away with action movies. It killed a number of films. It ended up getting a number of films cut, and most famously, it tanked a film that I really like, and I hope we'll talk about eventually, called The Last Castle, which was released released 2 months after 9/11, and it had posters up for months of an upside-down American flag.
Uh-oh.
And everybody was like, I don't want to watch this un-American twaddle.
Yeah.
And it just really hurt that film.
I want to watch a movie where the entire soundtrack is Toby Keith. But you know, it's interesting.
I've seen that movie, and that movie is not good.
Right. It's interesting. You mentioned 9/11 because Milhaka approached Paramount in 2001 with an idea for the sequel to this movie, but they said it was because of poor box office records with the original. They turned it down. But if you think about it, they still greenlit the remake several years later. So if their big problem with moving on with this series is that, oh, the first one didn't make money, why did they do the remake? And so it's like,
well, the year
becomes, I think, suspect in that case. It's like 2001. Why else might they not have said, oh, you made an extremely violent horror film that was actually cut down and given an X rating. It's 2001. We've just had 9/11. I think we're going
to
pass.
They came. The thing was, is they had an idea for a gimmick movie, and they loved the idea for the gimmick. And everybody was all about horror remakes because horror remakes were just making lots of money. So anything that had a recognizable title, they didn't care. No, you know, nobody at this point in history cared whether the movie did well or not. The question was, can you say that title and people go, oh, yeah, I remember that movie. Whether they actually remember that movie or not. Because it was one of those things, like, when they greenlit that, I was like, oh, yeah, My Bloody Valentine. I remember seeing that when I was a kid. But it was like, oh, shit, I haven't watched that. I haven't seen that movie since I was on HBO when I was a kid. So, you know, mid to late 80s. So I don't fucking know what that's really about. I remember it had a cool miner with a pickaxe, but what the fuck?
Yeah.
But I recognize it. So yeah, I'll give it a shot. I'll watch it. Because that's how they were greenlighting things at that point. But at this point in 2001, horror remakes were not the big thing. This was still the tail end of the disturbing behavior era, where it was all about, you know, it was all about post-Scream slasher flicks.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like it would have actually worked fairly well because there was a resurgence in popularity in the slasher film following Scream. I mean, you look at Urban Legends, you look at I Know What You Did Last Summer, like, those movies were starting to make a lot of money to the point the studios were considering, like you said, like, the new wave of slashers. So, again, I'm like, the only thing I can think of is a reason that they actually turned down or completely shied away from another My Bloody Valentine wasn't box office. It had to be something else. But that's neither here nor there. Here's a funny story about this movie. I was in Montreal a couple years ago, and I was at this, it was part of Fantasia, and I was at this art gallery. When I got in and got my pass, it was a time of day where they had stopped showing movies, but they still had this art gallery exhibit open. And the art gallery exhibit was basically an imaginative piece where they teamed up Canadian filmmakers with Canadian artists to create this fake history of Canadian B-movies, like Roger Corman type Canada-centric B-movies. So it was like, you know, the Ice Monster of Nova Scotia, or like, it was a movie about a crazy maple farmer. Like, and they made these fake posters for these movies that didn't exist. And I was
my favorite is Sorrier.
Sorrier, yeah.
Which is about this terrible, horrible killer who apologizes, you know, after he kills you.
Exactly.
I'm very sorry. I'm so sorry.
Mine is the girl with the moose jaw, I think, is my favorite one. But so I was looking at this poster, and I was talking to this guy. He's like, oh, do you like this
one?
Tim Horton Ween, absolutely. I was like, yeah, I really like this one. And I assumed he was the artist. And we were talking, and I was like, yeah, actually, there's a few Canadian horror films that in real life that actually exist that I do like, and one is My Bloody Valentine. And he's like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, I love that movie. And he goes, I directed that movie, and it was George Milhaka.
Nice.
And we had this whole conversation. I was like, yeah, absolutely. And he talked at length about, I was like, yeah, I really love that they put out this, the 2009 version with all the footage put back. And he's like, oh no, that's not even close to all the footage. That's not even close to all the things that we shot. And when you watch, you know, the Blu-ray, the DVD from 2009, all of the kills are really fucking severe. Like, to the point of, like, some of them,
the theatrical version is very not.
It's very not.
In fact, there's certain kills you don't actually see.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it almost feels like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where, like, what's implied puts enough of a picture in your head to say, oh, that's a really violent movie. But when you watch it again, you're like, oh, wait, no, it's actually not that violent.
Yeah, no, you really, you know, the death in particular that really kind of disappoints me the most, because I sat down to rewatch this today, but I ended up watching, I didn't realize until the end that I was watching the original theatrical.
Yeah.
You know, there's the death of the girl in the shower.
Yes.
And you don't see... Not only do you not see her death, you don't see her dead at all. You only see the reaction of the boyfriend.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a little weird. And that's the disappointment to it. It's not like, I need more gore and titties. it's literally that thing of like, you know, it feels like there's something missing. It's the one, you know, there's two death scenes in that movie that feel like there's something missing. It's that and the hot dog kill.
Yeah.
Where you feel like it's a, like there's some, like there was an unnecessary cut.
Yeah.
And like it was really sewn together. But that one really stands out because at least with the hot dog kill, you see the body later and it pays off.
Right.
There's no real payoff with her.
Yeah,
and it feels like a lot of setup without ever, you know, really paying off, and it's just unfortunate.
There are two kills that I think in the extended edition that really stand out as far as they completely change the tone of the movie. In fact, one of them is the woman who's killed and her body is discovered inside the dryer.
Yes.
The
Mabel.
Wow. Yeah. Mabel's body. It's not her murder. It's the reveal of her, but her murder is actually really intense and really kind of reserved. Like it's not a splatter kill. It's not anything that's played up for, you know, any kind of creepy Schadenfreude or anything like that. Like it's a really intense, unsettling scene. And then her body's found in a dryer later. In the extended version, like her body's found, it is a frighteningly realistic corpse that then the dryer kicks on and it's just like tumbling over and over again. It's such a realistic looking corpse that apparently when they mailed it and it went through customs, it caused a big problem. Like, there were, like, Canadian officials, like, knocking on Milhaka's door. They were freaked out about him sending this body through. He's like, it's fake. Like, you guys know it's fake, right? So, and then there's the kill of Happy himself, which his death, the way it's set up, is actually really cool because he's trying to play a prank on the kids because he doesn't feel like they're taking him seriously. So he sets up like a fake Harry Warden dummy to pop out of this doorway, and he keeps testing it over and over again, and he goes to leave, and then just he has this thought. I don't know if it's like, maybe I should test it one more time, or I didn't like the way that last one looked. So he goes and opens the door again, and it's the real Harry Warden, and he kills him. In the extended version, the pickaxe goes completely through his cheek and knocks his eyeball out. Like, it is like hardcore gore.
Which they then redid in the remake.
Yeah.
And did in 3D.
Oh, thank God. Thank God. But it's like, those are the kills I think that stand out the most. That and the very first kill in the movie, which is this sort of non sequitur scene where two miners are down in the catacombs, and one of them starts to take off the outfit, and you realize, oh, it's a woman, because you can't really tell with the fucking bulky jumpsuits and the helmets. And
you always use that excuse.
I do. Yeah, in the dark, it's all the same minor.
I can't really tell. You know, the junk. I don't know.
She got a lot of spelunk in the trunk. So she starts.
Oh, God damn it.
That's right. That's
God
right.
Damn it, Brian.
So she just keeps stripping, and the other person's just standing there, still in the garb. And then he all of a sudden shoves her backwards onto this spike. And in the extended version, like, there's a lot of spike coming through the front of the chest that's not in there at all in the original version. So, yeah, you can see how each death has. And the hot dog kill, like you were mentioning, which I think we should clarify, is not someone killed with a hot dog.
No.
Because that would make this movie ridiculous.
No. And that's one of the great things about this movie. The reason why this movie, one of the other reasons this movie holds up, is this movie doesn't ever go for the cheap laugh. And like the hot dog kill we're talking about is a guy is put face first into a big, large pot of boiling water that's boiling hot dogs.
Yeah.
And it is, and it's a gruesome concept, and it's a great shot the way, you know, the way it's done. And, but just if you end up watching the theatrical cut of this on accident, which, you know, some of us might do, it might just happen because they're not clearly labeled. Mm-hmm. You end up going, oh, wow, that was a weird cut. But all of the ideas of the kills in this movie are either very realistic or very gruesome. And that one in particular is just kind of a, God, what a horrible fucking way to die.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's pretty extreme.
And the effects after the fact on the corpse are just disturbing in their own right.
And the effects are really well done. Like even, you know, in the versions that feel kind of unfinished with the extra violence. I mean, there are effects in this movie that actually made the director throw up when he saw them. So, I mean, you're talking about some really well-crafted, some really painstakingly realistic gore effects. That's really interesting. But then you take all of these things that all kind of sound like they're dipping in and out of convention with the slasher film. And then they do something really interesting, which is that they create this myth of Harry Warren. They create this origin story for a sort of almost pseudo-supernatural slasher, and then they completely turn that around and make you realize, oh, the Harry Warden story? Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Total bullshit.
By the way, that is also one of the things I was going to talk about earlier, but decided to wait towards the end of this episode, because now we're going to head into a bit of spoiler territory for those of you that are like, I haven't seen this movie. Perhaps I should watch this if Cargill and Brian agree on this. That is also an element they borrowed from Friday the 13th.
Somewhat, but the thing is, they never develop the idea that the little boy and the, I mean, they kind of hint at it, but like in this movie, they're full on telling you. They go to great lengths to establish Harry Warden as the boogeyman. I mean, it would be akin, and this is what I said before about the combination. It would be akin to watching that whole scene at the beginning of Halloween, where Michael kills his sister in that long, you know, steady shot that's completely unbroken, and then at the end of the movie, it's not Michael Myers killing. Like, that would be more like what we got here.
No, it's Laurie's best friend.
It would be Laurie's best friend. Like, that's more what's going on here. In Friday the 13th, they hint at, yeah, oh, this boy died in the water, so you think, okay, it must be, but it kind of makes you feel like you're the detective who's going to figure that out. Like, it doesn't lay it out for you and use that to create a boogeyman. You never see the person who's doing the killing, you just see hands.
No, but this is where this evolved, and they said, hey, let's do, you know, let's go all out and paint this as the legend, and then the big turn. And, yeah. And Friday the 13th, the first one has that turn.
The first Friday the 13th has that because it's borrowing a lot from, the early slashers borrow a lot from Italian Giallo.
Yes.
And almost every Italian Giallo is about somebody who was wronged in their childhood getting revenge, which is why Prom Night is probably the most Giallo of the American slashers, because that movie is like right down to the fog and the glass and the leather glove.
Ripped off Old Boy.
Okay. So saith the Cargill. Yeah.
Ripped off Old Boy, went back. Amazing.
But the thing is, so it's like Friday the 13th doing that feels like more like they were borrowing from Giallo. In this film, like I said, I think what it does really effectively is it blends the things that work about Friday the 13th with the things that work from Halloween. So it's really, it's like it's borrowing from, it's ripping off somebody who ripped off somebody else, and then it's also ripping off the person that they ripped off. It's like rip-off-ception. It's crazy that way, but I think it really works, and I really like the way they combine it, because they really do create this formidable boogeyman in Harry Warden. And then they just completely turn that story around, and you realize that Axel is the one doing it, and it becomes more of a whodunit slasher setup, which, you know, is something that came to dominate a lot later on.
By the way, spoiler alert.
Yeah, I said spoiler alert. And you said we were talking about the ending. I think by this point, people are pretty familiar with the fact that we're talking about the ending.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how this happens. You know, this is one of the interesting elements of this film and the weakest element of this film. The ending.
Somewhat.
No. The ending has some issues. It's not that it's Axel. In fact, there's some really cool elements. Like, my favorite element of it being Axel is that Axel ends up getting caught in that rock slide.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, wait, he's still alive. And they start digging him out, and they find that it's the arm they have is a severed arm, and they look in, and there he is. And he runs off, cackling like a madman, and doesn't get caught. They don't kill the killer. The killer runs off into the mines, which we know is a big complex, and he's down there and can get out.
So he might effectively have become Harry Warden.
Yes.
He's become the legend.
And it's
Lone Star all over again.
It very well could have been a part two where it's the legend of Axel.
Yeah.
And we never got that, sadly. But that's also kind of cool, because I love the fact that we have this, you know, very final version of this movie in which the killer gets away with it. He runs off and he's still out there, and he's still scary as fuck. And he killed a whole mess of his friends because he was nutty.
And because when you find out, and again, this hearkening back to Friday the 13th, hearkening back to Giallo, he was the son of one of the two mine supervisors from the 60s who was then murdered out of revenge by Harry Warden.
Yeah.
So he's kind of taken up the mantle. He's gotten rid of Harry Warden, and he's taken up the mantle himself.
Yeah. Now, my problem with this, what I was mentioning, the weakness of it, is there's some spotty writing there towards the very end, where, you know, the kids have figured out, oh my God, it's not really Harry Warden, and the cop's like, oh, I know. Yeah, no, I got a phone call like 20 minutes ago in the movie, and we didn't bother to show it to the audience because we didn't want them to know yet. So, but yeah, no, I totally know. But we don't know who it's Axel. Oh God. Oh yeah. So we totally could have told you that information without spoiling who it was.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. It's one of those things that we should have seen that scene with the cop and him finding out that it's dead, so that we as the audience know, holy shit, this isn't Harry Warden. This is someone else. Who the fuck is it? And then you get what they ended up doing in the remake, which is one of the few elements that really worked, which is the, oh, we've been following these two protagonists fighting over this girl. It's entirely possible it's one of them. Which guy is it? Is it the guy we're kind of siding with, or the guy we feel for but haven't spent enough time with in the movie? Mm-hmm. And it is we don't really get that moment to really process that. And I feel like that's the, had we gotten that, it would have ratcheted up this movie just a little more and pushed it further into classic status. Because personally, as far as I'm concerned, of the 1981 crop of Friday the 13th knockoffs, I think this one's the very best.
Absolutely.
I think it's the one that definitely deserves revisiting. There's a lot of shit in that pile. There's a couple of interesting nuggets, a couple of interesting gems. Mm-hmm. But then you end up with stuff like Madman Mars, that makes you want to poke my eyes out. And I have so many friends that are like, oh, what are you talking about? That movie's great. And it's like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. And despite the, I mentioned earlier, despite the look of the killer, I actually really don't like the Prowler. I find it incredibly boring, which is the Barry Zito or Joseph Zito, who directed Friday the 13th Part 4.
Yeah.
His like World War II type slasher movie doesn't work for me.
Yeah, no. It's for those of you that ever think about going back and trying to do the 1981 run, it's a hard run.
It's a gauntlet.
It is a gauntlet with a few nice little, it's where milestones. So by the time you get run through the gauntlet, you look at My Bloody Valentine and go, this is a fucking masterpiece.
Yeah.
How did this happen amid all this? And how is this one not successful?
Yeah.
And the reason why we all know this one, the reason why this one has the longevity it does, is this is one of those that was released that was very cheap to get on VHS, and every video store in the country had it. So every mom and pop shop that those of us, you know, Gen X film nerds walked into in the early 80s had My Bloody Valentine with that amazing cover right next to Sleepaway Camp and Slumber Party Massacre.
Oh boy.
And it was just those covers just melted your wee little young brain, and it's like, I can't wait till I'm old enough to watch this. And My Bloody Valentine, it really, really does hold up, and it's just such a good film.
I want to say something really quickly about the production. That story that made me laugh is that, so Milhaka makes the decision to shoot in actual mines, the Sydney mines in Nova Scotia. And often they were shooting 900 feet underground and had to restrict the specific type of lights they used. Yeah. Because if they had used the wrong kind of light, it could have caused a methane explosion. And they chose this mine specifically because it was very rustic. It had that kind of half dilapidated atmosphere that really works for a slasher film. Well, here's the problem. When the local residents heard that, oh my God, they're going to shoot a movie here, they spent $50,000 to have the mine painted and dressed up so it looked nicer, because they're like, oh, they're going to be shooting a movie here, we want to make this look nice for the movie. And the film crew shows up and goes, what the fuck did you do? Wanted it specifically because it looked like shit. So they had to spend $75,000 of the film's budget to undo what the town had done.
This is exactly what happened in the movie Go.
Really?
Yeah, they tell this story in which they went and spent $50,000 to rent the location of a grocery store, and they found this perfect rundown grocery store, and they were really happy with it, and they're like, this is perfect. And so they paid the location fee, the $50,000, to rent the store for several days so that it was shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, oh, well, we're going to be shut down for a while, and we have all this money. Let's renovate and do all the renovations we've talked about for years. So they show up to this perfectly renovated, beautiful grocery store. And they're like, wait, no. So they had to go and find another grocery store so that they can meet their days. But yeah, so that sounds exactly like the kind of clusterfuck that would just drive you fucking nuts. Oh my God.
Also, bonus fact, Quentin Tarantino named My Bloody Valentine as his all-time favorite slasher film. So,
really?
Yep, that is a truth.
That's
fact.
That's interesting.
Yep.
In this town on Valentine's Day, everybody loses their heart.
Well, that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And I feel like...
I wonder what this is going
to
be.
I feel like it has to be chocolates in a heart-shaped box. I mean, even better if you can find a heart-shaped box full of chocolates that are also themselves heart-shaped. You know what? No. Better still if you deep-fry a pig heart and put that in the heart-shaped box. You know what? Better yet, ditch the idea altogether and get therapy. Because if that last idea appeals to you, you should probably just ignore the other things I said.
I really feel like I've got to, you know, I often joke around about disagreeing with you on these.
I'm just going to let you start picking these from now on.
You could always ask. Because there's...
Yes, Cargill. What did I do wrong this week? What's the correct junk food pairing?
A TV dinner.
A TV dinner? On a engine block.
Cooked on an engine block.
Yeah, okay. It's decent.
Go outside.
It's decent.
Cook up on the engine block in the cold. Your TV dinner, bring it in and eat it along with Hollis.
And you have to wash it down with a bottle of
Moosehead from the north.
My favorite scene in the movie: she comes to the table and goes, "Who ordered the Moosehead?" They're all drinking Moosehead.
Every box in the movie, like even down in the mines, there are boxes of Moosehead. Like Moosehead is everywhere.
It's like, lady, you're gonna have to narrow it down. It's the only beer they apparently serve in this country. So
yeah, and also is mentioned in Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
There you have it.
In one of my favorite scenes of Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Oh yeah,
Moosehead from the north.
From the north. So that's it for the show. I hope you enjoyed this first chapter of our holiday horror series. I want to remind you again that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher, and you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, as well as like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Twitter at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Massaworm.
And you can find me at Bri Guy Salisbury on Twitter. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. Or you can check out the wonderful blogs and podcast over at oneofus.net, my home away from home. But yeah, that's going to do it. Mark your calendars for the next show. Wherever we might end up on the calendar is kind of nebulous at this point. But
it is the holiday season.
It is the holiday season, indeed. And please do...
Tis the season for juggling release dates.
Yes, indeed. And please, I didn't say it before, but please do use those Amazon links. We'll have an Amazon link for this excellent edition of My Bloody Valentine. If you want to buy that, go ahead and click on that link to get there. But until next time, for Cargo, this is Brian saying, from the heart comes a warning filled with bloody good cheer. Remember what happened as the 14th draws near.